And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have an exciting show this evening. We have Don Ledger, and he's going to be talking about the Shag Harbor incident. I think it's one of the most intriguing cases on record. I'm excited to talk about that. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the UFO updates and in just a minute. And I want to thank everyone that supports the show. We are now live on YouTube. And if you want to watch the show, that is, we are live every Wednesdays at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you can't support our show and you'd still like to hear the whole show, you can, of course, watch it live. Or you can also go over to the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's Thursday evenings from 10 to midnight. There's another radio station that plays our show in full, and I will get you that information. I'm not sure of the time. Our date, but I will get you that information as well. That's it for me. Alejandro, how you doing?
I am well.
And you're going on a little R&R. That's coming up pretty soon, yes?
Yes. Yeah, in just a couple weeks. Very exciting. So the week after next, so it can't come soon enough. And luckily, next week is a short one because of Memorial Day. But I will be going on a cruise, sailing the seven seas. Actually, I'll only be sailing one, maybe two, actually. I don't know if it's a Sea of the Gulf. I think it is, the Sea of Cortez. So, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's great. Awesome. So I have kind of an announcement, too, for everybody. And the mid-June, I'm going to be heading overseas again. And this time... I'm going for 42 days, which is a long time.
Whoa.
I know. I should be more excited about it because I will be going to like Crimea and places like that. But I think I'm going to, for my own sanity, I might run the show on YouTube because I don't have a radio schedule like I used to. So I might run the show on YouTube, which would be 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, during the day. And I don't know how people are going to like that, but hopefully they'll come back. But I think instead of me getting up at 4:30 in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was I was doing that last year, I might just do the show at 8 o'clock in Russia, which is 1 o'clock in the Eastern Standard Time. So that is something. It's not in stone. Matter of fact, you're welcome to email me at martin@podcastufo if you have some negative or positive feedback about that.
So, you know, if you did that, I would probably be able to join like live on the video.
Oh, man,
that'd be fun.
That would be really great because I know it's really hard for you to do that now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only do it every once in a while. So
yeah,
that would be awesome. That would really.
Yeah.
I mean,
because I'm so busy, and I hate to say that I hate it when people are like, I know you're really busy. Everybody's really busy. So I don't mean to say I'm busier than anybody else. We all have busy lives, but that I really have to turn down a lot of shows these days, especially in the evening, because I've got to make sure I have time for family and stuff. And and so that's what makes it hard to do the evening stuff. But during the day is a lot better for me. So that would be a lot of fun.
We will stay in touch on that. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So anything going on? There are some things going on in the UFO world. I saw your blog today. Yeah. You want to talk about that first? Kurt Russell?
Oh. I want to talk about that last. Now you just
Said, you want to talk about that last, Kurt Russell?
Yeah. But now you gave away the big secret. But that's okay. People probably, some people know. But what I want to talk about first, it actually pertains to your guest.
Oh.
Because you're talking about Shag Harbor, and there's some Shag Harbor news.
That's right.
Yeah, you ready for this
I'm
one?
I'm ready. Yeah.
So Shag Harbor was a famous UFO incident. And in fact, the Canadian government has some information about this on their site. They have the Canadian government has an official like a UFO website and where they talk about a lot of UFO stuff and the Canadian government's, you know, researching of UFOs, which only lasted a short period of time. Really interesting stuff. And so they do have a description and a file on the Shag Harbor event. And I've got the link and I've got that information posted here. But essentially on October 4th, 1967, you know, the civilians and some Canadian mounted police saw this object go into Shag Harbor. And you'll be able to see more about that. They never figure out what the heck it was. And it's often referred to as Canada's Roswell. Of course, you're going to hear a lot more about this from Don Ledger details, so he can get into that. But in order to memorialize the event, there was a group of people trying to do a 50th anniversary of this event in October, you know, just prior to October 4th when the event took place. They're called the Shag Harbor UFO Incident Society. They were hoping to get a grant from Canada's Department of Communities, Culture, and Heritage. They were sure they were going to get this grant, but they found out recently they were denied. So they were really sad. A story came out in the local paper and how they were bummed and you know, they're just going to have to rethink things. They still want to do something, but their budget is severely hampered and what they'll be able to do will be hampered. And out of nowhere, luckily, a mysterious donor read that article and decided to donate the money they need. So happily, they sent us a press release. I'm sure they sent this to others, but they sent OpenMinds.tv a press release about this and that they're happy that things will be continuing. So they got an anonymous donor, and they said this donor is a UFO researcher, and this is very mysterious. This donor said that they didn't want anybody to know their identity was, but they did have a public statement to make. And wait till you hear this one. So this is what the donor says. Although there is much I can't reveal, without any hesitation, I can say the Canadian government and the international community it answers to appears to be concealing what happened in and around the waters of Shag Harbor, Canada on October 4th, 1967. People with the connections, notoriety, and finances are working hard to challenge how we view the world around us. Shag Harbor is one of the smoking guns that will be used to achieve this.
Excellent. Wow. I actually got an email from the vice president of the Shag Harbor Incident Society.
Oh, you probably got the press release too then.
Well, I got an email directly from, I guess I'll say his first name, Brock.
Yeah, that's who I got it from.
Yep. And basically, he saw that I was covering the Shag Harbor incident with Don, and also I did recently with Jordan Bonaparte. So he said, "Hey, look, you're welcome to come on up to our, you know, to our conference." So, sure. You know what? I think I'm going to do it.
Really? Are you that far? I mean, you are.
I can drive. It's probably a good day and a half drive. I mean, just to go north in Maine, they say takes 7 hours to hit the Canadian border from Maine. It's a big state. So, so I'm thinking it's maybe a day or a day, you know, maybe a little bit longer than a day drive. And you know what? Darn it. I think I'm going to do it.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Maybe do a show or something from there.
Yeah, you're dedicated.
Yes,
that's a long time. Yeah. Well, cool. Do that. That'll be really cool to tell us how it goes.
I think I will.
Yeah.
So what else is happening?
So what else? Another piece of information that we received. We have just such great friends all around the world. And this one is from Andreas Mueller. He is a occasional contributor from Germany. He actually runs his own website that covers the paranormal and what he calls frontier sciences, and called GRIWI, essentially. But he had some exclusive news that actually has made news and of all places, unfortunately, largely the British tabloids, which we do not like because they usually screw stuff up. But and Nick Pope spoke with him. He's always working with these damn tabloids, even though they blow things out of proportion. But anyway, the story was this, that remember those 18 files? So the British government released all their UFO files in batches over many years. The last batch to come out in 2013. Well, during this period of time they were releasing these batches, John Burroughs, one of the witnesses of the Rendlesham Forest incident, a famous UFO sighting that happened at a in Britain, at a base there that was a U.S. Air Force base. They were leasing the base. And he wanted to find out more information. He's been researching to find a government documents on his sighting. And he wanted these particular government documents. He asked the UK government for them. They said, well, we're releasing the documents. You're going to have to wait. It's going to be in there. Well, when the last batch came out, they weren't there. So he said, hey, guys, where are these files? They have they pretty much stonewalled them. And finally, a British citizen had read a story about Burroughs and trying to get these files. So he asked the UK government, where are these files? And the UK government publicly actually answered his request and said, oh, we're sorry. I guess we do have some more UFO files. We didn't release them all. And we'll go those out to you shortly. This was in 2014. Actually, they said it would probably take 9 months to get them out. 2014. They've been delaying ever since. So people keep asking, where are these files? Where are these files? Even the House of Lords, one of the ministers said, where are these files? When they asked the Department of the, Ministry of Defense, they keep saying, oh, we're going to release them. We're going to release them. Well, the last date they were supposed to come out was March, this March. They said that we'll finally have them out in March. Well, lo and behold, March comes and goes, and there are no files. So Andreas Mueller, he pegged the UK government. He said, hey, guys, where are these files? He said they're going to be out in March. They're not out. They responded and they said, due to the upcoming election here in the UK and the rules relating to government departments during the pre-election period, the files will not be released until after the election. We are working to ensure that the files are ready for release as soon after this period as possible, hopefully around the middle of June.
Hmm. Well, you know, in a way, I know they keep putting it off, but in a way, I can see that, well, it'd be kind of exciting if they cause a stir, but, you know, that's got to be the reason. They just don't want to deal with any controversies around election time. I guess I get that part.
I cannot believe you're making excuses for the UK's withholding these files.
Well, you know, if they stuck to the March thing, it probably would have been just fine, right?
Yeah, why couldn't they do it? I mean, it's now been 3 years.
Yeah.
For goodness sakes.
If they delay it again, they really have no excuse for it, really.
Yeah. And you know, at this point, since they've delayed every single time they were supposed to come out, I mean, the confidence level that they actually will come out in June, at least for me, is pretty low. So there's no saying.
Do they have a similar regulation in England as they do in the United States as far as the Freedom of Information Act?
They do. Yeah, it is very similar. And Nick Pope has spoken to this. Of course, Nick Pope worked for the Ministry of Defense investigating UFOs for a few years in the 90s. And he talks about how even though they have a FOIA, it's still very easily to hide the documents. They could have been destroyed. They could have been moved somewhere where nobody knows where they are. Or they could be moved to a private corporation. in which those people do not fall under the Freedom of Information Act, theirs nor ours here in the United States, so they would have no obligation to share those files. So there are a number of scenarios and ways that those files could be kind of swept under the rug. And so, you know, he feels that there are other files out there that may never come to light.
Yeah, well, not to go completely conspiratorial, but, you know, the government, I'm sure, does things through private contractors in order to avoid any type of congressional, I'm talking about our government, congressional investigations or that could be possible.
Well, it seems that the military at times, and I'm sure other agencies, will destroy files if they're that, you know, incendiary. I don't know if I'm saying if they're that, you know, revealing of crimes or something really negative to which they feel they never should come to light. And maybe they feel that there's no value to the information anymore anyway. I think people do destroy documents probably on a regular basis. I think we've heard of that several times. So some of these documents could be destroyed. In fact, my next show will be with Nick Redfern, and we actually already did the interview, and he and I talked quite a bit about this when we talked about Roswell. We'll both be speaking out there, and he has some of your listeners may know, and maybe you'll need to talk to him at some point about it too. He has a alternative theory when it comes to Roswell. And so, yeah, it's you know, like those are files that they say they've lost. They've been destroyed and they're gone. So,
yeah. But Chase Brandon found a box that said Roswell on it.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the whole problem with the Chase Brandon thing. He found a box in the CIA's library. And apparently... and this is a library any CIA agent can go into in Langley. It's right there, I guess, in the lobby. You do have to be a CIA employee to go in there. But this box, it apparently just had books. And in particular, it was Corso's book he read. So it doesn't seem like it had anything secret or just it just had, you know, like books and media stuff, nothing that the public could didn't see. Although it is interesting that Chase Brandon says the material, including, you know, the Day After Roswell book, convinced him that, you know, there was something to the Roswell incident. But yeah, it doesn't sound as though he necessarily read anything that was top secret. And if he did, I mean, that wouldn't be the best place to have it, where any CIA agent can go in there and say, oh, look at this. Aliens are real.
Not only that, I'm sure that anybody would realize the fact that if there was a file box with Roswell material in it, it's not going to say Roswell on the outside. It would say box number C2357 or some type of code numbers or something. It wouldn't.
Well, in a library, it might say Roswell.
Yeah, I didn't know it was in a library, actually.
Yeah, if it was official. If it was official, you know, documentation, you're right. I think it would say box XYZ or box 12345-753, you know. But since it's a library, it makes more sense even that it is less sensitive material, because it's just, you know, they have it in their Roswell section. They have sections for probably everything. Maybe even a Martin Willis section.
Well, it's similar to I had mentioned on the show months ago that you know, an ex CIA agent, not a former, a retired CIA agent, had, you know, Magic 12 documents in his footlocker, which I thought was, you know, meant something, but it could be just a curiosity thing. You know, I never did get anywhere with his son or anything on that. So I think it's just something out of curiosity that someone may have in the topic itself, and just, you know, collect that as it's probably fun for them to read through something like that.
I agree with you 100%, my friend.
Yeah.
So we're kind of going long, but we have the big story you plugged at the beginning of my section here. So you want me to go over the Kurt Russell thing?
Go long. Go long.
All right. And I love this story because, yeah, it's Kurt Russell says he witnessed the Phoenix Lights, the famous, maybe the most famous, or at least the most seen UFO event here in the United States. So Guardians of the Galaxy 2 just came out. I just saw it this weekend. It's excellent. I loved it. And Kurt Russell's in it, and he is great. So they are doing this interview for BBC One's The One Show and in the UK. And it's Chris Pratt and Kurt Russell. And the host opens up this folder that says top secret. And he says, I've gone through the international files to find an interesting story for you guys. And I didn't see the whole thing, but I have seen some of it. And apparently they talked about how he found a UFO story, and Chris Pratt said he doesn't really believe in UFOs or something. And so he started to read this UFO story, the host. And he says, you know, guys may be interested that in March, he didn't even say a date. He just said that in Phoenix, Arizona, there was a pilot that was coming in for a landing. He was flying with his son, and he saw six lights in the sky and these UFOs. And upon landing, he reported these UFOs. The control tower said they didn't catch anything on radar. So the host, says mystery trying to bring some excitement to things. And Kurt Russell says, the plane number to that plane was Bravo 2 Tango Sierra, and I know this because I was the pilot of that plane. To which the host go, oh my gosh. And Chris Pratt makes this funny face, kind of like, what? And so Chris Pratt didn't seem to be in the loop on this whole thing. So Kurt Russell says, yeah, I was bringing my son, Oliver, who is actually Goldie Hawn's son, and he's not married to Goldie Hawn, so it's not even really his stepson, but I guess Oliver considers Kurt Russell his dad because he grew up with him and everything, so he calls mm-hmm. him his son. And Oliver Hudson, so Kate Hudson's brother, so he's an actor as well. So he was flying his son to Phoenix to drop him off so he could see his girlfriend. And as they were flying in, they see these six lights. Oliver says, hey, Dad, what's that? You know, should we call this in or are we okay? And Kurt Russell said, I don't know what that is. So he calls into the tower and says, hey, we're coming in for a landing and we see these lights. Should we be concerned? And they said, well, we're not catching anything on radar. So he says, okay, they land. He does report it as a UFO because he says, you know, he didn't know what they were. So he determined it was unidentified. So he does report it. But they land. He drops off his son. He flies back to L.A. That's it. He nor his son talk about it at all after that. Then one day, and he doesn't say when. I'm guessing this is recent because he hasn't shared this story before. But he says Goldie Hawn was watching a TV show about UFOs, and they were talking about the Phoenix Lights, this big incident, of course, on March 13th, 1997. And they say that there was a general aviation pilot who was flying with his son who reported seeing the lights. And that just triggered something. He said he felt like Richard Dreyfuss. So when he was watching the show, he felt like, I know something about this, but I don't know why I know something about this. Why does this sound familiar? And when they talked about the pilot, he said it just clicked and he said, hey, I think that was me. So he went to his flight logs to see, and sure enough, the flight was on the same time as the Phoenix Lights. So he says, yeah, I saw the Phoenix Lights. It was unidentified. And what's funny is he says what he thinks is what he feels is the weirdest thing about this whole event is that if he wouldn't have seen the show, he would have never thought about it. He said, you know, for some reason it went out of his head that they had seen this UFO and reported it. And he hadn't thought anything about it until he saw the show.
Isn't that something? I've heard so many times where people have said something similar to that. Where a sighting just, they forgot all about it until something jagged their memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they see something really weird. And they just ignore it. They're like, wow, that's really weird. What the hell is that?
Yeah.
And then they go on with their lives and don't think twice about it.
Now, a listener, and of course I want to thank you out there, listener, whoever you were, that sent me that video, I think it was a few weeks ago. But I watched, like, it was one of those things where I watched, like, really late at night or in the middle of the night when I couldn't sleep or something. And I forgot all about that until you brought it up the other day. Yeah, this is great. Kurt Russell's I really always liked him a lot. He's a cool actor. He seems like a really nice guy, even though you don't know him in person. But just the interviews and things I've seen, he just seems like a real down-to-earth type.
He does. He seems really cool. And I love the story because, I'm really close with my girlfriend's daughters, especially the youngest who's graduating tomorrow from high school. Cool. And I understand. I feel similar. And, you know, it's really cool. And it speaks to Kurt Russell that, I guess Kate and Oliver Hudson regard him as their father, even though he isn't, just because he's been there for them.
Right.
To help raise them and everything. So, and even though he and Goldie, after all of these years, have never gotten married. So it's really cool. And he is cool. He seems like a cool guy and a great actor. I've always loved him, too. And he is really good in Guardians of the Galaxy, too. Great movie, if you haven't seen it. I loved it. And I would say I liked the first one, but I think I like this one a little more, actually.
Really? Wow. You know, that's so unusual to like the second, you know, the second in a series.
I know.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And it is unusual. But, of course, even though it's unusual, it's wonderful when that happens.
Right. Hey, had you ever, this is totally off subject, but have you ever watched the movie Overboard with them two in it, with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell? That is so funny. That's
yes,
such a great
it
movie.
Is really funny. I mean, one of the lines from that really sticks in my head, and I just think it's so hilarious for some stupid reason because it's a stupid scene. It's when the little kid, like Goldie Hawn, they drive her nuts, and Kurt Russell comes home, and she's like catatonic, and the little kid goes, I like it when she goes, ba 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 ba.
I totally remember that because I've watched that movie so many times. That's really funny. Yeah, you get that down pretty good.
Yeah, really funny.
Yeah, awesome. All right, well, I know we went extra long, 20-some-odd minutes.
Whoa.
6 minutes, almost a half hour. But you know what? I'm cool with that. So
good.
You have a good one, and I'll be talking to you next week.
All right, you have a great one, too. Talk to you next week.
All right, everyone, hang on for just 1 minute after this quick music break, and you'll hear the phone ringing. I'm going to be calling Don Ledger. Hey,
hello.
Don, welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis. How are you?
How are you doing, Mark?
Good. Welcome. You were on my show, God, I think it was back in 2012, maybe. And
I think it was.
Now, there's a lot of talk about Shag Harbor lately, just because it's coming up, you know, mostly because it's coming up on the 50th anniversary.
50th.
And if you could, can you, for the person, there was someone in our chat room. Now, I do have a bunch of questions for you that came in last week. And so I'm going to be asking you a bunch of questions. But if you can give like a, you know, like a 10 or 15 minute nutshell of how the whole thing happened and how you got involved in it actually as well. I'd like to know that. You don't live real far away from there, or do you? Do you live far away?
Oh, a three-hour car drive.
Yeah, 3 hours, okay. That's probably not really that far for up there, right? Yeah.
No.
So if you can give kind of a nutshell of how of what transpired back on October 4th, 1967, and then, you know, further on, like I said, we have a couple of questions that branch out of there as well that'll be coming up. But sure. Just if you go ahead and talk about that, I'd be grateful.
Yeah. Martin, where are you at? Where's the show?
I'm in the state of Maine.
Oh, you're in Maine. Well, you're across from us, not south of us. You know Maine goes further north than Nova Scotia does, do you?
No, I didn't realize that.
True.
I think I have to do a lot of driving. I plan on getting to Shag Harbor with the conference this year. And I think I've got a long, long drive. I haven't mapped it out yet, but I think I'll be on.
There's a ferry goes across, but it's pretty expensive.
Well, someone told me the ferry doesn't run anymore, but I'll check into that.
I think it is this year.
Oh, okay.
Again.
Well,
who knows?
All right. Yeah. So let's hear about what happened back in 1967.
Yeah, you want to go into
sure,
that?
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
Martin? Yeah. Okay. Excuse me, and I seem to have a lot of throat clearing going on here tonight. October 4th, 1967, and there was a portion of that night where there was quite a few UFO reports, and all over the southwestern part of Nova Scotia. If you look at your map there, it sort of looks like the tail end of a lobster, and without the fins. And if you sort of take that back end, that area down there was maybe as many as 30 UFO sightings by different people. Nothing spectacular, you know, usually nocturnal lights in the sky and so on. But around 11:30 that night, that's when Laurie Wickens and Dave Kendrick Laurie Wickens and his friends were coming back from Cape Sable Island at a dance over there. That's a little island that's got a causeway going out to it. It's about 13 miles to the northeast. When they were in their car and they noticed a string of lights in the sky on the right-hand side of the car sort of traveling along with them, but passing. And they figured it was up about 1,000 feet or so. And finally, as they were getting closer to Shag Harbor, the thing started to curl around the front and made a beeline towards the water in the harbor, towards just past the western side of the harbor. Now, they just had barely caught up with it. And when it went behind a line of trees, and they came around a bend over a little hill there. You'd see it yourself when you get down there, and it opens up right onto the water there. You're right on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. So this at what used to be called the Irish Moss Plant, and he's lost sight of it. But one of the girls in the car thought she heard a whoosh and a bang. Anyway, they pulled over in the gravel parking lot right on the water. On the edge of the water, and they looked out, and they could see this dark object, hence the title of the book, and with a pale yellow light drifting on the water or under its own power, sort of going away from the shore. At that point, it was only about 800 feet out, which wasn't very far. So they were a bit frightened, a little puzzled by this. Lori and a male friend of his thought that maybe this was a crashed airplane drifting on the water. So they got it back in the car. Not, of course, we're in 1967, of course, no cell phones or anything like that. They went a little further down the road towards Woods Harbor, which is only maybe a mile away, and stopped at a gas station down there where there was a payphone, and they called the RCMP back in Barrington Passage, which is on going way back up through Shag Harbor again, way up to the northeast. Well, at least another 15 miles anyway, and into Barrington Passage, and got a hold of the detachment there, the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police Detachment, and got a hold of Corporal Victor Rubicki, told him what they thought had happened, or at least Laurie did anyway. Laurie's about 17 going on 18 at this time, And Werbicki said to him, he knew him, have you been drinking? And Lori said, no. He was kind of ticked off about that. Well, I've been drinking. He says, you know, I think an airplane's crashed out there. So Werbicki's phone started to ring, and he said, look, give me the phone number there, and I'll get back to you. He says, my phone's ringing. So when he answered his phone, he had about four or five more calls from people saying they thought they saw, it looked like a lighter, an airplane lighter, and it went down towards the water. It looked like it crashed in Shag Harbor. And after about the third call after that, he was really taking this serious. He got back to Lori and told him to get back in the car and go back up the Irish Moss plant and keep an eye on this thing until they could get there. So in the meantime, another couple of young fellows there were also coming back from the same dance, and Norm Smith and Dave Kendrick. If you have my book, Maritime UFO Files, there's a picture on the front, and that's Dave Kendrick. Now, Dave was driving the car, and his friend Norm, he was on the right-hand side, and they saw basically the same thing, but a little, maybe a hair after or just before. It's uncertain. And but they didn't go any further than Norm Smith's place, which was just in at the edge of Shag Harbor on the opposite side from where the object went in. And Dave Kendrick drove home, told his mother about it, and then went to bed, and that was the end of his participation at that during that evening. Norm Smith told his father about it, and his uncle lived on the other end of the of this duplex-type house that was there. And he went outside to show it to him, and they saw the police cars going down, two Mountie cars going down, heading in towards the direction of where the object might have gone down. So they figured something was up. They go down and give a hand. Now, I'm pre-seasoning here. You know, this is really trimming
sure,
it down
yeah.
for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so they ended up getting down there, and when they got there, the Mounties were there. There were three Mountie cars, and probably about, all told, maybe 18 to 24 people, seems to be the best estimate I could get over the years, standing around watching this thing out on the water. The Mounties were watching it. Lori Wickens and his crew were there. Norm Smith, of course, was there with his uncle. And they saw this thing drifting out on the water, still either under its own speed or drifting with the tide. The tide was ebbing. And so now, October night was cool, but it was a clear night and no moon. So the Corporal Werbicki decided he wanted to get a search party together. They considered taking a dory out that was tied up alongside of the Irish Moss plant, but that's a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the fishermen around here used to carry them in on their larger motor-driven fishing boats as a safety item, or just to go out and do work off the side. But anyway, then they figured, well, there was a bit of a lop on. Maybe they'd it was a little too dangerous. So Werbicki decided he was going to go to a house just a way up the road and call some of the fishermen that he knew, see if he could get one of them to take their boat out and they'd go out and see if they could help out. Just as he was about to leave, the object seemed to sink. It looked like it sank. And what they had seen out there was this dark, lens-shaped object sort of either sitting on the water or slightly above it with the pale yellow light on it, just glowing. Everybody there said, all the fishermen have all said, no, there wasn't any buoy or any kind of a lighthouse or anything out there that would give that effect. They knew, you know, they know the water like the back of their hand there. So Werbicki had the two O'Briens there, or the two Brian, two Rons, I should say, Ron O'Brien and Ron Pond. Ron Pond was the rookie. He was left there to take down testimony from the other people. And Ron O'Brien, and who had been also sent off to another house to make a call to the Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax to see if there's, you know, if they'd had an airplane crash or anything, or any aircraft were missing. So anyway, those two eventually ended up going back up along with some of the people from the site, and they went to joined up with two fishermen that Werbicki had scared up down at the government wharf in Shag Harbor. And they got on the boats, went out to the western approach to where this thing might be. And they crossed the water. We had about a mile of water to cross between the western approach and Oder Island, or Bon Pétage Island, and trying to find this thing, which, of course, had already submerged, apparently. on their way, they ran across a slick of a yellow covered foam. It looked like shaving cream about 4 inches thick. Now, the people in the area and most people that live around the ocean around here in Nova Scotia know what sea foam is. You see it all the time when you're at the edge of the water. But everybody said, no, this wasn't anything like sea foam. It looked more like shaving cream or whipped cream sitting on the water. It was about 4 inches thick and very even. And there was about, you know, a half a mile of it strung out going down down this swath where the UFO had been. And it was about 80 feet wide, just going by the lengths of the boats. And it was about two boat lengths wide. So they cruised around in this stuff. They didn't like the idea of being in there and just in the general area looking for survivors, because they really did think it was an airplane crash. They thought the foam might have come from some kind of mixture of gasoline and salt water. They didn't know what it was. In the meantime, Coast Guard had been called over in Clark's Harbor over in the Cape Sable Island, and they sent a boat over. It took about an hour to get there because it was 13 miles away, and it only did about 10 or 11 knots. And when they showed up, they asked to talk to Ron O'Brien, who was the on-scene commander now, and they told him, because he's the one that called the Coast Guard in the first place over up in Halifax, and they said that there was nothing missing. There was no planes missing from up and down the coast, down in the east coast of the United States or in Nova Scotia or up the east coast of Canada. Nothing was missing. So they were wondering then, what are they looking for? They searched through the night right up till some of them 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, and the first two boats out, they decided they better get some sleep because they hadn't slept since 3 o'clock the morning before, and it was pretty late now. But by this time, there was about 6 fishing boats out there helping out, plus the Coast Guard cutter, as they called it, lifeboat, with Ronnie Newell as the skipper on that, and they continued to search. And the search carried on for, you know, the next day anyway, as they cruised back and forth. By Friday, because when this thing happened, it was happening at 25 after 11 in the evening on the 4th, and we quickly went into the 5th. On the 6th, on Friday, the Navy, by this time, had sent down some divers via helicopter and a deuce and a half, which was, you know, a military vehicle on all their equipment and so on, got on some of the boats there, and they went out and they dove in the water starting around 1 o'clock in the afternoon and went to about 6 that night. They came out of the water, said they couldn't find anything. Water there was only about 80 feet deep and pretty clear. And So they wondered, and then again, still, well, what's going on here? What were we looking at, you know? And they didn't know. Nobody could tell them what had happened. And, of course, as we know, it went on a little further after that. But there's no secret about this portion of the action, if you want to call it that, of the event, because it was in the newspapers. The Chronicle Herald was a huge newspaper in eastern Canada. Probably still is, but it's not as big as newspapers used to be back in their day. And it had, you know, 2-inch banner red headlines saying, you know, maybe something, UFO crash in Shag Harbor, RCAF, Royal Canadian Air Force at the time. Mm-hmm. So, not much happened after that. The rest of the story didn't develop until maybe almost 20-some years later when Chris Stiles stumbled upon a guy who had a story to tell. And by that time, I was involved, or got involved shortly after with Chris, and we started to look further into this case. So the rest you know if you read the book.
Yeah. So I'll ask you some questions along the way here. First of all, did anyone take samples of that yellow foam at all?
No, and well, nobody had any reason to at the time, but. There is a letter, one of the letters that said it's a shame somebody, a margin note, I believe it was, saying it was a shame somebody didn't think to take throw a bucket over the side and take a sample. But Norm Smith, if I recall, was supposed to have put his arms over the side and tried to lift some of the stuff out of the water, but wouldn't come up. His arms came up wet. Ron O'Brien told me later on that whoever, he didn't know the name of the fisherman at the time, because there's maybe 6 or 7 on each boat, young fellas. He said he rubbed his arm and looked at his arm to see what was on there, but it just looked like it was wet. There didn't seem to be any odor or anything to it, although in general there was an odor on the water of sort of like sulfur, a sulfury smell.
Wow. Yeah, well, that would kind of make sense with the yellow. And do you think that when it landed, like I heard you say, around 800 feet out, do you think that it quickly soared to, we'll talk about it later, where it goes up to toward Government Point up there, but do you think it right away kind of moved away sort of toward that direction or somewhere?
Well, in order for it to get away from Shake Harbor and between Oder Island and Shake Harbor, if you look, because you're almost on the shoulder of Nova Scotia, which is turning around to go into the Gulf of Maine there. And it would have had to get out of that area and then make a bend to the left and go up the coast to get up to Shelburne. Like I said, you know, it's, by the time the Mounties were there and everybody was standing there and the thing went underwater, it was a considerably further distance out on the water than when Lori Wickens and his friends first saw it land on the water. And although people at the time thought it was a crash, it seems to be more apparent, at least to me anyway, that this was some kind of a controlled landing into the water for whatever reason.
Right. Now, what part of this whole event did it change from a possible airplane crash to UFO?
Well, you know, the Air Force, the Air Desk in Ottawa, that was Squadron Leader Baines, had taken the first call on this thing and lined up the Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax and the assets and Maritime Command, you know, the Navy, the whole nine yards, and got them all put together. It was actually the Navy, or the, I'm sorry, the Air Force document that has UFO underlined, 1, 2, 3 underneath, marked on the document, and Squadron Leader's name is above it. And then they started calling it the dark object, and then there was a UFO in one of the documents. So nobody in the area would have thought, probably even thought to call it a UFO. I don't even think they'd really experienced much in that area before Shag Harbor. You know, they might have heard about it on TV or something at the odd time, but it's not the kind of thing they'd sort of, you know, get involved with or know anything about. Maybe ghost stories down in that area, but not so much about UFOs.
Right.
So if it went to UFO, it went because the media made it that way. But first of all, it was the Air Force that brought up the idea of a UFO. But again, it was an unidentified flying object, so it's not like they're making out anything to be an alien object. Although this thing certainly has all the stink on it for an alien object, but. There you go. That's what I have for you right now. I have my own personal ideas for later on, maybe, but I haven't fully developed them yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know it kind of gives UFO a bad name, and that's why a lot of people are using UAP, because people automatically think, oh, you know, you're calling it an alien. But really, the term UFO just means unidentified flying object, and that's really all it does mean.
Yeah.
And I remember Kucinich, however you say his name, you know, took a lot of grief. And he said, well, it was an unidentified flying object. That was during the 2008 campaign here in the States, a politician. So one of the things I thought of is what kind of myths are out there that you would like to squash? In other words, are there some stories out there that are untrue that are told about Shag Harbor?
Such as?
I just wondered if you have heard things over the years that you think that you know that aren't true that people have. And the reason I'm bringing this up because that happens with big cases like Roswell. Or Phoenix Lights, you know, there's always some side stories that are not, you know, not accurate at all that kind of get spread by, say, tabloids or something.
Yeah.
Is there anything like that with Shag Harbor?
Well, I don't ever actually recall seeing anything where it was outrageously off the mark. I mean, there's been some conjecture around, you know, the very first off the cuff remarks by some of the people, oh, it was some fishermen shooting around flares, which was nonsense, of course, you know. And one of the other ones, what it was, some kind of a sonar buoy or something, that came up at one of the conferences we had down. Well, it was actually more like a talk we gave down in Shea Harbor years ago at the elementary school that's right next to the water where this occurred. And, had a gymnasium, big gymnasium. There were about 300 people there, I guess. And this one guy jumped up and said, you know, he said he'd found a sonar buoy on the shore. And he thought that's what they'd seen floating in the water. Well, you know, strangely enough, when I was a kid around 13 years old, we used to go down to the dump. There was a junkyard, Zatzman's Junkyard, where we used to be able to go down there and pick up all kinds of odds and ends. Oh, you had to pay for them. But what they did have was, because Halifax is a military, you know, naval base, Air Force base and everything else here, they used to drop sonar buoys when they were practicing or even tracking subs in the out on the Atlantic. And the used ones or some of the outmoded ones, they'd just get rid of them. And we could buy them for 75 cents. I had four or five of them at the time. These things were about 3 feet long, maybe about 8 inches in diameter, with a little tiny little amber-yellow light on it that was not meant to be seen over a great distance. It was meant to be seen from, you know, from the aircraft that dropped it, just to keep track of the thing. And then after a while, the certain little plugs would dissolve and the thing would sink to the bottom after its usefulness was over. But, I mean, there's no way anybody would mistake this and, you know, 18 to 24 people would stand around, including three mounties, and look out at this tiny little light they couldn't even see from, you know, probably more than 100 feet away and claim that that was some kind of an anomaly, you know. And certainly wasn't what the people, you know, the witnesses saw coming down out of the sky, which was three and four and five sequentially flashing lights in a line. That's probably the one that annoyed me more than anything, but I've never really heard anybody come up with any kind of an off the wall story about what actually happened in Shea Harbor. You're going to get the usual thing. Well, you know what it was? It was probably a secret military aircraft. That's the other one. Well, I've been a pilot for 34 years, but I've been I'm an aviation writer. I'm a journalist. I write about aviation, and I've been doing that for 10 years solid now. I was doing a regular column for 10 years for a Canadian magazine that's aviation, and dealing all of that, you know, all kinds of different aircraft, types of aircraft. I know what's up there flying. And we didn't have it in the Second World War. We didn't have it after the Second World War was over with Kenneth Arnold and you know, Roswell and some of these other places. And we had some. Now we have some stealth aircraft, but I mean, we know what they are. There's only 19 of those stealth bombers. Two of them already crashed. And the old stealth fighter, well, that's a joke anyway. Those things weren't even supersonic, for God's sakes. But I mean, those kind of explanations is giving as a, it's they're secret military aircraft. That's what they are. Well, I mean, they thought that's what they were back at the end of the Second World War. They thought that's what it was during the war in the First World or the Second World War. But nothing that was ever able to be proved, you know. And there just wasn't anything around that could match what these things could do or the size of them in some cases. You know, even during the Second World War, some of these objects were recorded as being 800 or 1,000 feet long, or one was a half mile and in length, you know. But fortunately with the Shea Harbor incident, I haven't seen very much. I don't think I've seen anything where they've actually tried to make up another story surrounding it, you know, saying this is what happened, you know, and have a bunch of you know, space, as they call them nowadays, space aliens, crawling around the area, even though there was allusion to it, but by, you know, some of the witnesses on the other end of this thing up at Government Point.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I want to talk about that in a little bit. Going back to the yellow foam one more time, did that make before it dissipated, was that kind of almost like a strip? Like, could that possibly have been a trail of the direction that the, say, if it was a USO underwater moving, could that have been a trail that could have left?
Well, that's conjecture now, but probably a pretty good one. It's associated with because nobody knew what it was, and nobody knew what the other thing was. You sort of put the two unknowns together and come up with one big unknown, and that is pretty much the thinking. You know, that whatever this was, it was a byproduct of what, you know, this object that had gone onto the water and then went under the water. And I can't refute it, considering the fishermen that I talked to that were involved. Well, you know, Norm Smith, and I'm trying to think of one of the other guys I talked to. They also saw they saw it when they went out there, but they didn't know what to make of it. They said, you know, just definitely was not sea foam, you know, which is patchy to begin with. And it was about a half mile long by about 80 feet wide, a strip of it. And 80 feet is not much longer than 60 feet wide, you know, and maybe, you know, just spread out a bit or whatever. Who knows? I can't say for sure that it came from this thing, but, you know, it sort of has, you know, all the earmarks of maybe being some kind of byproduct or whatever this thing was or whatever it was doing. But whatever it was, it didn't seem to harm anybody. It didn't. It dissipated, as you mentioned, and that was the end of it. It was unfortunately somebody didn't try to take a sample of it and, you know, seal it off and then maybe have it examined later. They might have found something in
okay that. What about you know, some people, well, I don't even know if they had Chinese lanterns at the time, but you mentioned that someone mentioned flares. Is that an ongoing thing that people are actually saying it was, or is that just...
No, somebody mentioned it at the time, and then one of the reports said that it might have been some fishermen shooting some flares off, yeah. And it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. When they rode on the water, the only light was a pale yellow light on the object. As for them driving along Highway Number 3 inland, who was shooting flares inland? And I'm familiar with flares. You know, I've been around those things all my life, you know. Part of my family were fishermen to begin with, you know, particularly when I was younger. For one thing, if they had them, they used them on the boat. They weren't just, and this is a weak one, but I mean, they weren't just going to fire these things off for the sake of firing them off because they had to pay money for
right.
them. And, but right. They're just, a flare goes up, arcs over, comes back down, burns out on its way down. That's pretty much what it does, and they're red, you know, and there's just no relationship to what the witness has said. And we often find that in ufology, you know, and I hate that word, but there you go, people try to, I watched one of those programs on National Geographic the other night, UFOs Declassified, and they had an astronomer from Toronto, York University, I think it was, on there talking about, you know, what he thought people were seeing. Well, he had no conception of what the reports say, or, you know, what we've delved into over the years. And I'm not talking about Shea Garber. I'm just talking in general. That, you know, they started talking about Venus and Saturn, you know, and Jupiter and the moon and all this. It's just plain foolishness, you know. They just don't match into what the witness is saying.
Yes.
And you see that quite often. And it is quite annoying, actually.
Yeah.
And these people are taken as experts when they're really not in that area.
I have talked about that a number of times in the show where, you know, the story that, you know, the explanation that has been produced is so far off from, and there was another, Jordan Bonaparte talked about this other major case, and it was a 1970s. Where someone said it was Venus or something, and it has, you know, how could Venus move and turn and have flashing lights, and, you know, it's just so far off. Well, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we'll be back with Ben Hurl. He's from Australia. We're going to be talking about some Australian cases. So if you'd like to support the show to listen to the full shows and archives, just go to podcastufo.com. It's only $2 or more per month. Thanks a lot, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.